Ready for round two from Mr. Fugate. Number 69926, Fugate versus State. Ms. Butko, when you can take a breather if you want, and then to start whenever you're ready. And did you want to reserve time on this one?
I would reserve 3 minutes. May it please the court, counsel. We're here on a jury trial case involving Mr. Fugate in this particular case. Factually, this case proceeded in front of Judge Statler, and it went to plea. It was set for jury trial, but after the other trial went to conviction, a plea bargain was negotiated. That negotiation was for him to plead guilty to 2 counts of attempted lewdness, 57 to 144, running concurrent, and the state would recommend that. The guilty plea memo is very clear on that, so we don't have any wording difficulties. They're to recommend concurrent sentences. At the actual sentencing, the state stood up and made what was, Mr. McCarthy points out, is a short argument. Short arguments are often the most powerful. This court hears us for 15 minutes, not 2 hours. So we have a very short, very powerful argument by the DA, which breaches the plea bargain. And how do we know that it breached the plea bargain? Because Judge Statler told us it did. Judge Statler said, I don't understand how your argument is consistent with this plea bargain. On the one hand, you're asking me to impose less than the maximum sentences and run them concurrent. And on the other hand, you're making that argument to me. What was the state's argument? The state's argument was that Mr. Fugate groomed the victims and the parents, not just the victims. That when the preliminary hearing date happened, the DA went to the child's home, and the child was in a fetal position, having a mental breakdown. The child was beyond terrified. The hearing was continued. Continued, the child became a runaway. Continued, Mr. Fugate subjected this child to years of abuse, forever changed his life negatively. The other victim, Tyler, called Mr. Steggy to report he was having a breakdown. Mr. Fugate was blamed for that. Then the deputy DA there even attacked the statement made by Mr. Fugate's mother to say, no wonder you think he's a victim. This was well beyond the scope of arguing for a term of 12 years.
Ms. Butko, let me ask you, let's say for the sake of argument we agreed with you on this point. Ultimately, though, the sentencing issue is up to the judge, and the judge is not bound by the plea negotiations as far as the sentence. It's my understanding, you know, Judge Statler had his discretion to give the sentence he gave. It was within the statutory amounts allowed. So is it, what I'm saying, is it kind of a harmless thing? I mean, the DA probably shouldn't have done that, but ultimately the judge recognized that, and the judge can give whatever sentence the judge feels is appropriate within the statute. What's your thoughts on that?
He can do that, but he shouldn't have. My thoughts on that are when you witness a breach of the plea bargain as a district court judge that is so in your face that you call the DA on the carpet for it, you have an obligation to say, I'm not going to hear this sentencing. And I have been in these shoes, and I have seen judges look me in the face when I have witnesses lined up, say, ah, that's a breach of the plea bargain, and I'm not walking this path. I'm going to get off this case, and you're going to see another judge. And then you come back on another day for the sentencing. And we know in this case that Judge Statler sat there and said, I find this plea bargain repugnant. I'm not going to follow this plea bargain because I think it's too lax. He chastised the prosecutor for the bargain she entered into. So the remedy is strict performance by the state.
But Ms. Budko, didn't the DA have a Hobson's choice at that point? If you had unwilling victims to show up, didn't it make sense that they would be discounting the offer that they made? Otherwise, it's dismissal. So they had an opportunity to try to seek 12 years, which is not an insignificant amount of time. It's not inconsistent with saying he needs to be incapacitated, or dismissal. I mean, where did the DA stretch in explaining to the court why they made a 12-year offer?
The DA stretched when they went so far as to say, I went to this house and I saw this child lying in a fetal position, incapacitated, terrified.
Well,
that was not in response to Judge
Statler's. It's a factual statement, isn't it?
It may be, but it certainly breached the spirit of the plea bargain, because the spirit of the plea bargain...
They specifically indicated that they were recommending the 57 to 144.
Yes, and I think Judge Statler pointed that out well. You made a very passionate argument for a maximum sentence, and then you casually said, but we have a plea bargain here and I'd ask you to abide by it.
Is that what was actually said?
Yes.
They're asking for a maximum sentence. You're saying that's what the district attorney said.
What Judge Sackler said. What Judge Sackler said is your argument.
Did the district attorney say that?
No.
Okay.
No.
So that was, okay.
But we have both an implied breach of a plea bargain, too. It doesn't have to be, oh, they stood up and actually said the words. You can do it by spirit. They're held to a meticulous standard because 95% of cases in America go by way of plea bargain. It's a huge contract for the defendant.
What do we do, though, with the fact that I understand your argument and Judge Sattler's remarks, but what do we do with the fact that the other party to the plea bargain, the defendant and his lawyer, were there, and the lawyer did not say, in making this impassioned argument, the state has crossed the line and has repudiated the plea agreement? As I read Sullivan, Sullivan overruled Stats, and the DA was entitled to present the facts to the jury in support of the sentence that they were going to recommend and argue for. And it's troubling to me, you have no objection, and then you get the sentence and then you don't like it, so you're going to appeal and argue about it. I understand your point, and I think it's a good one. I'm not discounting it, but it's troubling to me that there was no objection and that this argument seems to me to be permissible under Sullivan, although perhaps right at the edge of the line.
So I can answer that by putting myself into Mr. Olson's shoes. The judge and the DA are having that argument. The breach of plea is on the record and noted. It furthers nothing.
Not in those terms.
Judge Sattler said, I think your argument isn't breach of the plea bargain. He said it. So why would defense counsel then be obliged to stand up and say it again when the district court has already said, I find your argument to be in breach of the plea bargain?
Where do you see Judge Sattler stating it's in breach of the plea agreement?
Well, let me find. So, he actually asked Ms. Samples, okay, wait a minute.
You have 2AA, 272. I'm looking at your reply brief on page 2.
So he says, this is the difficulty I have with the argument. All of the argument is predicated on incapacitation, keeping Mr. Fugate away from young men in society for as long as possible. And then you want me to run the sentences concurrent to each other. You want me to give him something other than the maximum sentence. How do you justify those two things? So he's telling her, you just basically made an argument for a maximum sentence.
But he did not make a finding that the DA had breached the plea agreement.
But then he says, the state's argument is an argument that cries out for maximum punishment allowed by law, and then a quick reference to what the actual plea negotiations are, and then the state sits down. How do you justify those two things? He asked for that.
Yeah, I see that. My point is a different one. You don't have a finding by the district court judge that the argument crossed the line over into a breach of the plea agreement.
I really think you do.
Okay, fair enough.
Really, because I think what Judge Sattler is telling her is, I don't understand your negotiations. I disagree with your negotiations. I don't understand how you can ask me to give him less than maximum consecutive sentences here. But then when you made your argument, you didn't ask me to give him that. You really asked me to punch him. You asked me to give him the maximum. And I think that's why Judge Sattler put it on the record, because he found it, both the plea offer, the plea bargain, and the state's actions in its argument, he found it difficult. Otherwise, he wouldn't have said a word. He would have just done what he wanted to do. So anyway, he says at 282, he says, so we go in, we make this argument, then we make the quick, by the way, please follow the plea negotiations.
But don't you think at that point it's incumbent on defense counsel, if they feel there's a breach, to say there's a breach, we need another sentencing judge, rather than wait and see how it plays out?
When every attorney has their own tolerance levels, I happen to be a little more boisterous than others, I would have probably said something. But Mr. Olson is a very kind Southern gentleman.
No, he's a total gentleman and a very fine lawyer. I'm not.
And he would not want to call Ms. Samples on the carpet, nor would he want to call Judge Sattler on the carpet. It is not his style. And I can understand why he felt he didn't have to do it, because the judge and the DA are already having the argument over whether the plea has been breached. The other flip side of...
Do you think it was reasonable for even the defense to expect that the judge would not deviate from that plea agreement? You know, just based upon the facts of the case and the presentation, the defense attorney who advised that client knew that they were getting a discount at plea agreement, a significant discount from what would probably ordinarily flow because of the trouble with the victims. But they knew that it was going to go to an independent judge who was going to make a determination about the appropriate sentence. It was independent of any plea agreement. So is there fault to go around, so to speak?
Their clients always know there's a risk of a maximum on any case.
There's no binding plea agreements in Washoe?
No. No, they don't do them. But what they do have is some standing law that says if you, as a judge, find that repugnant, speak up and get out. And Judge Sattler didn't do that. And you can clearly tell from all of his commentary that he found that plea bargain untenable. And he was not going to follow it. And so Mr. McCarthy says, I can't prove that. But I think Judge Sattler's words prove that. And his last word at the end of the sentencing, when he brought him back in to give him more time on the companion case, says it was always my intention. I think what we see here is we see a judge who has a very difficult case. He has a plea bargain in front of him. He chooses not to follow it. And had that been without the intervention of the state, making the fetal position argument and the terrified child, or had those questions been answered when Judge Sattler said, why did you enter into this plea bargain? That's when it would have been appropriate for those comments to come up. We ask you to follow this plea bargain because our victims were having difficulty testifying, our victims were in treatment, our victims have had a lot of problems. And I think that would have been appropriate. But to do it the way that it happened, it was, I think, an obvious breach of the plea bargain.
You would agree, would you not, that there's one thing clear. Mr. Fugate wasn't going to withdraw from the plea agreement.
No.
Seek to withdraw his plea of guilty on these two counts.
No, and Judge Sattler actually created that issue. There was never a motion to withdraw the plea filed.
We have about 3 minutes left. Do you want to reserve that?
Yes, I'll save that. Thank you.
Here we go again. I'm still Terry McCarthy. I don't think there was a breach of plea bargain in this case. You know, there was a time when people suggested when a prosecutor makes an agreement to recommend a sentence, he must recommend that sentence enthusiastically. That's been rejected. We look for that which is objective. We don't look for what did he really mean, what did she really mean. As for, you know, sometimes this comes up. Judges ask, why are you making this kind of deal? And I've tried to tell my young colleagues, I said, the appropriate response is, this is a considered opinion of the executive branch of government. Most judges, in my experience, don't take well to that because they want an answer. And most prosecutors have to give an answer. When it appears to be a lenient recommendation, they must be careful not to repudiate the recommendation. And that's what this prosecutor did. She explained to the judge. She said, this is why I made the recommendation. This is the question from the court. Why did you do this? And she gave the answer. You know, because I had this problem and I had the other problem. But then makes it clear, nevertheless, it is the recommendation. You know, you give this lenient sentence. Now then there's a question of what was perceived. I think Marshall McLuhan, the communications guru, said there is that which is thought, that which is uttered, that which is heard, and that which is perceived, and they're all different. So, unfortunately, all we have is a transcript, which doesn't tell us any of those things. But the question, what was perceived, seems to be by Judge Sattler saying, I'm rejecting your recommendation. So he perceived that was indeed the recommendation. The lenient sentence was indeed the recommendation. And why? Because he said, no, I'm not doing it. because the facts of the case call out for a harsher sentence. Well, that seems to be the role of the judge. And Your Honor, we don't have binding, we can't. The statute allowing binding plea bargains was repealed some time ago. We sometimes can enter into an agreement to have a joint recommendation. But even that, you know, the judge is too disregarded.
So a Cripps visit to the judge probably would have been the best thing if defense counsel and the prosecutor had gone to the judge in advance. Under Cripps, you could still talk to him about whether he'd be acceptable to that type of plea bargain.
Oh, I'm not a fan of that, having judges be involved in plea bargains.
So. Well, I think you could talk to him about Cripps. I think so.
I think this court has prohibited it, and because it certainly not in the presence of the defendant, where the judge says, "Okay, I'll do that." I know it happens. Judge Robinson down in Douglas County used to call it silver bullets. He says you only get so many silver bullets in your career. You can use them all up with one case if you want to. But I don't think it's appropriate to go and see the judge off the record. This court prefers everything beyond the record, and it should be. And a prosecutor can't bind the court to that which the court finds unsuitable. That much seems to be clear. Whether we ought to be able to do so, I wouldn't mind such a rule, but it doesn't exist. And so,
you do agree there's an outer limit where, like, let's say they agreed they would argue for probation in this case, and then they had gotten up and made the same arguments that they did in sentencing. Would you agree that that would violate, if not explicitly, at least implicitly, the argument? So that legally we would review it. I mean, do you read Sullivan to support that result in this setting?
I read Sullivan to say, get up on your feet. If the defense says, I agreed to an enthusiastic recommendation, and judge,
cut the enthusiastic out. Let's just have a straight deal that in this case they agreed to recommend probation.
Right. I think that Sullivan says, get on your feet. If the judge, this is not the deal we made. We didn't, if you are perceiving this, you know, that the recommendation is being something other than for probation, I need me a new judge, and we need to stop this. But this court has previously...
But Sullivan allows the appeal. Sullivan goes the other way. Sullivan affirms it, but allows the direct appeal even though there was no objection.
Well, it's not a hard and fast rule. There ought to be one, I think. There ought to be a hard and fast rule. Sullivan footnote just says it weighs against it. It seems to indicate that the parties didn't perceive a breach. And I agree. But perhaps there ought to be a hard and fast rule. If you want it reviewed, get on your feet, make the objection. Ask for the relief. We disapprove of gamesmanship, rolling the dice and see how it comes out and then decide whether you're dissatisfied. I think the general rule ought to be, if you think you need a new judge, say so. If you think your judge has been contaminated by an argument, say so.
Because for all we know, there's a hope, a strategic object of, well, maybe the judge will be shamed into approving the recommended sentence because the DA went too close to the line. I mean, I don't know what was going on in the mind for no objection.
I don't know what was going on in the mind of Jack Olson or Judge Statler or the prosecutor. I can't.
Yeah.
And nor can this court. And that's what the argument is asking you to do, to determine what was really meant by the prosecutor, by Mr. Olson, and by the judge. Well, I'm reasonably familiar with the constitutional establishment of this court and the court's authority, and I recommend against advancing down that road. And I recommend...
Didn't the judge, in fact, point to part of his justification for imposing the sentence, the medical doctor's report indicating his high risk of reoffending?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, there were reading through the transcript, there was a number of factors that he considered, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, the sentence. My thoughts on the sentence is lawful and justified. the court had that authority to deviate from the recommendation and did so. And there's plenty of evidence justifying it. But there needn't be any. I mean, if the sentence is within the statutory limits, it's a lawful sentence. So I don't see the problem there, whether there was evidence supporting it or not. Although there is plenty of evidence supporting a harsh sentence in this case. I think the court said he has simply refused to conform himself, refused to obey basic laws like don't sexually abuse children.
And wasn't part of the parole and probation's or the psychiatrist's concern that he was denying that he did it to the psychiatrist but admitting it to the court?
The court noted that he had made contradictory statements to the court and to the psychiatrist,
and that augured ill for his rehabilitation.
Well, it would seem to be that also entered into the prosecutor's comments about the mother, where the mother said, you know, he's just got in with bad people who turned on him. Well, the bad people didn't molest, you know, sexually abuse the children. It was your son that did it. And so the narcissism found by the psychiatrist is troubling.
Mr. McCarthy, could you refresh my recollection? What was the minimum sentence on each count?
I cannot. I'm sorry, I don't know off the top of my head.
It was less than 57 to 144. Oh
yes, this was a bargained recommendation.
I don't think probation was available, but
it might be with, you know, with prior convictions. I'm reasonably certain that probation is not available, even with a favorable recommendation.
I guess the reason I pose the question is that in as much as the defendant was not certain what the judge would do, the state, too, would not necessarily know what the judge would do with regard to the sentence.
No one can know.
So is it a breach of a plea agreement for the prosecutor to come in and say, here's the facts why we feel this individual should be incarcerated, and certainly incarcerated for a period that is higher than the minimum?
Yes. That's not a breach of the plea bargain at all, especially when you have, you know, the defense is saying, come in a little bit lower, you know, let's get a lenient sentence, and the prosecutor can say, no, this is why you have to impose this relatively harsh sentence.
But in this case, there was a justification made by the district attorney to impose the agreed upon sentence of 57 to 144, and part of that was re-victimizing.
Right.
And so it just didn't come out of...
No. The court asked.
Right.
And prosecutors are sometimes in a difficult position when the court asks. And
at the end of the sentencing hearing, it seems like the judge focused primarily on that doctor's report.
Yes.
And what was indicated in that?
I'm sorry, you asked
what was indicated in the report?
The details of the statement was very unfavorable. It was narcissistic and likely to reoffend, as I believe it was likely to reoffend. So what all it said, I really don't recall, but it was not a favorable recommendation. So I suppose it is possible that to have a harmless breach of the plea bargain, but that's not my argument. I'd say there was no breach.
Don't you think it's a bad message to young prosecutors to let a prosecutor do what this prosecutor did?
You know,
we could call it harmless, and you may be absolutely That may be the solution, but it's an awful message to send to the prosecutors that they can go ahead and make a deal like this and then just come unglued with the judge. And the judge coming unglued.
We've talked a lot in my office about what to do when the judge asks for justification for the plea bargain.
But this judge was a DA. He's been to the rodeo before.
He's a former DA. Yes. When a judge asks, you got to respond. You got to say something. And my suggestion that you tell him, judge, I can't tell you why. It's off the record stuff, and I'd have to move to recuse you if I told you what. I do recommend that to the.
That's why we don't have peremptory challenges for criminal judges in the state. That exact reason, because we get a lot of money in our travel budget from the judge.
Well, I think that it would be unwise to tell young prosecutors to just tell the judge to kiss off when they ask that question. You're going to have to give an answer. I got a little bit informal there, please pardon me. But you're going to have to give an answer. And this was an honest answer. This was, these are the problems I had. Those are appropriate considerations. The damage done to these children is an appropriate consideration. So there shouldn't be a rule by this court that says a prosecutor can't argue appropriate considerations as long as ultimately the prosecutor says, let me make it clear here, as she did, I'm arguing for the agreed sentence. And the judge perceived that recommendation too, and the judge said, I'm rejecting your recommendation. Not in those words, but he ultimately said, no, I am rejecting it. So we should find then there was no breach by the prosecutor, no perceived breach by the judge, no perceived breach by the defense attorney. And just simply affirm and move along.
What do you say to your opposing colleague's read of the transcript by Judge Sattler? Do you disagree that he found breach?
I do.
Yeah.
I think when he says, no, I'm rejecting your recommendation, he said, the message is, I perceive your recommendation as being the lenient recommendation, and I am rejecting it. That's, he's seemed to say, you have a very strong argument, and yet you've recommended leniency. Please explain that. So, asking for an explanation is not the same as saying I perceive a breach. I'm out of time.
Thank you very much. Buckley, you have about 3 minutes left. And you may want to answer Justice Hardesty's questions about that.
Definitely. Justice Hardesty, the two charges were a 2 to 20. In prison, probation was available, hence the reason for the psychosexual evaluation, which did so much damage in the case. The interesting thing...
Did the defense argue for probation?
No, the defendant argued for the plea bargain, period. Never asked for anything less than the 57 to 144. And after, when Mr. Olson made his rebuttal argument to Mr. Stege's sentencing argument, he again reminded Judge Sattler of the plea bargain and asked him to enforce it.
But he was under no obligation to do that.
No, but...
And he made it clear at the beginning of the hearing that he had no obligation to follow the plea bargain.
Oh, we're talking about Judge Sattler.
Yes.
I was talking about
Mr.
Olson. Mm-hmm. Mr. Olson asked Judge Sattler to follow the plea bargain on his initial argument and on his rebuttal argument with the second case. He again said, please follow the plea bargain. Now, the plea bargain and the difference, just in case you're wondering why we're here, the difference is 20 solid years in prison, and on the underlying end, it's 39 extra months to the board, just on count one. Then it's another 96 to the board. So as far as the plea bargain, it's an interesting question. Did it end? Does the state free from a plea bargain once a judge rejects it? Or can the state actually argue that maximum consecutive sentences are appropriate at this stage of the case?
What's your view of the question I posed to Mr. McCarthy? In a case in which probation is a possibility, must the DA remain silent in a plea agreement such as this and not even raise the specter that, judge, if you're thinking about giving this guy probation, suppose this had been the argument, or if you're thinking about a 2-60 sentence in this case, I want you to know some additional facts about this matter.
Had that been the argument, we wouldn't be here. The argument
was... How is it any different?
The argument was an impassioned plea for a maximum sentence. It wasn't, Your Honor, this client has a history...
No, no, no. It was an impassioned plea for incarceration. She never said, I want the max.
But the parties were agreeing to incarceration. I don't think there was any question Mr. Fugate knew he was going to get time on this deal. Nobody expected anything less.
But there's another issue. The agreement called for a concurrent time. And even the prosecutor, after making the request, agreed to concurrent time.
That's correct.
So the judge was the one who decided on consecutive time.
That's correct. And he decided after the state's argument, and then after, when he asked the state to justify the plea bargain, and in his mind, the state did not justify this plea bargain. The state was wrong to offer it, and it was untenable. And as you read his comments, he was angry at the state and said, there's cases you just lose. This was one of them. I wouldn't have made that offer. He had a hard time saying, I'm not a prosecutor, I'm a judge.
Thank you, Ms. Becko. Ms. McCaughey and Ms. Becko, thank you for your fine arguments in both these cases and your briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted, and the court would like to welcome our favorite college student, Julie Perigary, in the audience with her mother, Leslie. So welcome to the Supreme Court.